I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Perfect harmony. Perfect harmony.
I'd like to buy the world a poke
and keep it company.
Deserves got nothing to do with it. It's his time, that's all. It's 2017. Don Draper III, sick and tired of hearing how his grandfather changed the marketing game back in 1971 by buying the world of Coke, is sat in front of Pepsi executives and is ready to cement his legacy and finally earn his right to be called a Draper. He's done all the research, spent the last year covering all that's been hip and catchy with the young folks while keeping faithful to the older demographic. You know the ones. The ones that can actually afford to buy shit. And he's got the perfect idea. Diversity. People want diversity. Breakdancing and photography. Art in the form of a cello being played on top of a roof while a helicopter takes a subjective point of view shot of a racially ambiguous man. It makes sense, he says. People like POV and porn. We need a Muslim woman too. She needs to be wearing a headscarf, but also have piercings while wearing a pair of jeans, so the audience know that it's her choice. Draper III can feel that he's losing them. It's too edgy, young and far too colourful. So he pulls out his Trump card. Trump is one of those words and phrases that we can never, ever say for the rest of time. Law and order. People like law and order, whether it's the show or whether it's hashtag Brexit or Trump. Like clockwork, all the heads in the room start nodding. They can picture it now. People of color enforcing law and order while being refreshed by a cold can of Pepsi. But Draper has better ideas, and he's swinging for a home run here. He quickly thinks about the only two things that sell better than law and order. A white savior. I mean, how else could Japan have been saved if it wasn't for Tom Cruise, right? And a Kardashian. The group of middle-aged individuals with names like John, William, and Beauregard. They like it, but they can't see where it's all going. So Draper, filled with joy and self-idealization, squints his eyes and makes his carousel pitch. Kendall Jenner, he says. She sees a protest going on while doing a photo shoot, clattered in lipstick and blonde hair. She connects with the racially ambiguous minority who's no longer playing the cello on top of a building. And it shows how empathetic she is, and she rips off her hair. She walks down towards the camera, wipes off the lipstick, but not before throwing her wig at a black woman who, you know, will be the only black woman in the play with an important role. And Kendall will walk through the protest as it all grows tense and ready to spill over with our handsome law and order police officer. Kendall will hand him a Pepsi. A slow panoramic shot of a woman helping to refresh our order keepers while connecting with the youth. Fade to black. Pepsi. Welcome to Distorted Shades of Grey, where we do it for the culture and you don't have to. I'm Clicio Sanwa.
I'm Mark Stern.
Mark, first and foremost, how's your week been?
It's just got a whole lot better after that stunning panoramic introduction of one of the worst ads I've ever seen. You've given that more art than I think it actually deserved.
I will get to it later, but like, you know what, we'll do it now. How does it get created? I was just thinking, how on earth does this like ad get created, right? And my person I listened to, Pramati Jones, was talking, saying people say that sometimes that they must have not had like a black person or like a person of color in the room, but sometimes they do. Like sometimes they do. They don't get listened to, or that person might be giving the idea and just be tone deaf as well. So how does that ad get made?
I know. It's like lots of people and lots of money and lots of time will have been spent on that production. And like, did they think it was a good idea? It must have been a good idea that somebody's thought there and been like, this is going to make Pepsi great again.
Yeah.
Not sad about that choice of words. Yeah.
It was entirely in-house as well.
Yeah, I saw that. And yeah, I did marketing at university, and part of me is like, is it the worst ad in the world or is it the greatest ad in the world? Because here we are a week later talking about a Pepsi ad. Like, did you think you'd be saying that at the start of the month?
Except
that you just spent a week agonizing over a Pepsi ad?
An ad,
is it worth it?
Yeah, an ad that's been taken off the internet by the Pepsi. They're no longer running the ad as well. I like how it's all the protest signs or stuff like join the conversation. So look, it's...
I mean, I feel like as well, because it came out, I think, I mean, they must have dropped it just after we finished recording last week's episode, yeah. And now we're a week later. I feel like we're almost late to the party at this stage. Like, what more do you elaborate on an advert that has been, like, canned so unequivocally in the space of, like, 24 hours?
It's funny you say that, because we here at the DSG podcast have found a way. and we found a way because we've wanted to talk about cultural appropriation for a while. And it started following an article in the New York Times about the English rugby team and their use of the song Swing Low, Swing Chariot, which in fact turned out to be an old Negro spiritual sung by slaves who were longing for death. So with that in mind, and this ad came through, we figured, look, this would be a great chance to actually sit here, talk about the idea of cultural appropriation, talk about what is cultural appropriation, what isn't, and try to get a definition for it. And I sent Mark an article, which was done by The Atlantic. It basically said, what does cultural appropriation actually mean? So it gave a couple ideas and definitions, and it was a conversation between two individuals about the word, and wanted to just get an idea, like, what, when you hear cultural appropriation, what do you like think of, Mark?
So there's kind of immediate sensitivities for me is probably around Scotland, the place that I'm from.
Mm.
I mean, there's like, if I think about this in terms of how I immediately approach cultural appropriation, you know, being Scottish, traveling the world, which I was really fortunate to do, now living in England, there's a very like clear image of what being Scottish means, which I always find interesting because it's never really Scottish people that are telling you. And I think it's very much based in this probably 19th century view of Scottish people and kind of Celts generally as being, you know, red-headed, fiery, you know, always willing to get in the fight, will drink lots.
So your groundskeeper Willy, basically.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of like, I don't want to say noble savage because I think that's got a racial element to it as well, but I think there's hints of that. You know, you can have Anglo-Saxon, calm, thoughtful, intelligent, well-educated up against the Celtic kind of, you know, wild, emotional, all of these counterpoints, which are very kind of prominent in the way that Scotland's understood in a British context, I think. So that for me is kind of the most personal, not because I feel like it's ever been like used pejoratively against me in any serious way, but I just think it's interesting. And I also think it's interesting because it very much motivates a lot of Scottish tourism, which brings a lot of benefit to Scotland. There's this kind of like shortbread tin image, like this picture of like the glens in Scotland with deer and people out shooting and walking around in kilts, that is A, very profitable for Scotland, and B, an image that Scots themselves will also buy into. Just because it's used commercially and other people trade it doesn't mean that being Scottish you don't also kind of engage with it. So it's this kind of like complicated idea about ownership and representation,
yeah,
and who's in control and who holds the power and who profits from it, that gets very messy. So I think I've got more questions than answers I do this week, because I can see that it's very much a double-edged sword in the sense of what I said. You know, there's this image of Scotland that everybody else trades on, consumes and makes jokes about, but that's also an image that I feel free to enjoy at points as well. So that's kind of my initial reaction when these sort of conversations come up. It's my immediate kind of inroad to it. Where do you stand?
I think what's interesting that you said there, and I don't necessarily think it's incomplete, when you speak about the whole noble savage thing, at one stage, everybody that wasn't British was considered a savage, right? Like, they thought the Germans were barbarians, they thought the French were barbarians, they still think the Irish are barbarians and stuff like that. So that kind of feeling of being seen as, like, lesser, I think that's always been there through time. And even through something like fucking Game of Thrones, the representation of the people up north, which are supposed to be the Scottish, feels kind of weird and iffy there as well. I think when it comes down to cultural appropriation, I always thought about it as a denigration or underappreciation of a group, of an idea, of a belief, of a society that's been, like, also been made fun of. And what the article actually speaks about is just, like, how they all kind of tie towards discrimination and racism, but then we add cultural appropriation to kind of make it easier to identify, but then there's loopholes within that that make it even harder to identify there as well. So, for example, is it cultural appropriation or is it, like, actual appreciation? And when does that appreciation become taken for granted? So I always see it as denigration of an idea, of a culture, of a language, of a tradition for the profit of other people that aren't necessarily from that tradition, place, time or culture as well. So an easy example that I get is someone says dreadlocks aren't cultural appropriation, and I sit down and I say, yeah, I can get it, right? Like, I understand where back in the day, back in time, nobody had combs, so cavemen ended up having dreadlocks, and that wasn't, like, a specifically thing that was just for black and brown or people with afro texture hair. But since then, and since that time, people who tend to be black who have, like, dreadlocks are seen and perceived in a different way. But then when, like, Justin Bieber gets dreadlocks, he's edgy and he's out there and he's trying to connect with a whole bunch of people. The same way where Nicki Minaj is twerking and she's a whore. Taylor Swift is twerking and look at her, she's trying to appeal to a broad range of people and she's edgy and she's crafty. So it's certain things like that, and I suppose the most recent one was, like, Honey G, where it wasn't necessarily her appropriating, like, blackness, it was just her appropriating that working class inner city culture, which, again, are very appealing to white people who grew up in that environment, you know what I mean? Like that Ali G kind of creature. There are people who are genuinely like that, who are terrified of sirens, who are denigrated, who are mocked, who are laughed at, and then here she was on TV rapping like that, like, getting exposure and getting money and, like, being put on a pedestal. So I think cultural appropriation becomes one of those things where you've got to be really, really careful to make sure that it's denigration of a society, a group, a context, a culture, a belief, and the profiting of it by other people in that as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's super true. And if one of the things I read, it kind of delineated five key, I guess, metrics that you would apply to any given situation. Because that's the other thing, the context is everything, I think, is one of your phrases that you sent me during the week. And I think that's so true. These situations are very individual, and just because one thing might be appropriation on that day doesn't mean that a slightly different situation will kind of have a different conclusion if you apply these. So one is power imbalance. The second one is the accuracy of the portrayal. Third, insensitivity of the portrayal. Fourth, has it considered any colonial history? And fifth, payment, right? Like, who gets paid, who's banking them checks? And I think kind of the examples that you just gave, you know, kind of fail quite drastically across those five terms. But you can equally go and find situations where culture is appropriated in a appreciative manner, and where, you know, the melting pot of cultures has kind of created new, you know, with art, is it, or music or film, or, you know, people's whole character that is a hybrid of cultural appropriation in a way that we move forward, in a way that we communicate in new ways. I know, going back to the Scotland idea, there is a really famous actor here called Sanjeev Kohli, who's on Still Game, who is constantly tweeting and talking about what it's like to be Scottish and from Southern Asia. And, you know, he posts photos of him in kilts with funny tartans. And it's just like an interesting message of how these two cultures have come together. And here's a person who has lived in Scotland for most of his adult life and gets to integrate a lot of different traditions and a country we move forward in a way that Groundskeeper Willie, as you mentioned, is very kind of steeped in a history of Scotland that might not be accurate to how we are today. And similarly, a band, Young Fathers, that I really like, is two immigrants to Scotland and a Scottish kid from Edinburgh who all went to school together and have this like amazing like kind of fusion of hip hop, indie rock, and kind of, I want to say one of them's from Ghana, like this like kind of West African vibe, and it's like absolutely fantastic and incredible live. And, you know, so these things are like defining a modern Scotland in a way that Groundskeeper Willie or kind of pictures of men in kilts shooting deer really isn't accurate anymore.
That's amazing. I think those 5 points are quite stellar, and I think you've kind of challenged my perception a little bit, because I've always had this notion that the All Blacks and New Zealand, where I'm from, loving the haka was cultural appropriation, because there's so many parts of Māori culture and Māori sovereignty that we keep our mouth shut about, or we're absolutely rubbish about. But we will go out there and we will like show New Zealand and show the Māori patterns and love the haka. And the haka is ranked on ESPN as one of the top 100 sporting events that you need to see. You know what I mean? And 60 years ago, the haka was done by a team of all white dudes called the All Blacks going around England, where only one person knew the entire actions of the haka, and he wasn't even Māori. And so it's been a very, so that's always had an interesting thing, but at the same time, to a certain extent, that's also a shared history. That's also a shared kind of getting together. And if it's going to help move the country forward and the nation forward, I suppose that is a good thing. I just sit there and feel like it can be a very incomplete thing that people sit there and go, hey, no, we still love Māori. Look at us. We put the haka in front and we do the haka all the time. And everyone, like, I learnt the haka at like 5 years old kind of thing. You know what I mean? So it'd be interesting to see how that fits. And we wanted to have one of my family members who was Māori give us a bit of a word on it, but couldn't get her to record with us this week.
Yeah. I mean, this was all new to me when I first came to New Zealand in 2011. And obviously, my girlfriend Claire is from New Zealand, so I get have the good fortune of being able to go back and visit every year or two. And it always interests me from the outsider, as an outsider to New Zealand, the haka, because it is such a like sporting, like, jewel. I think anybody that's interested in sport, or really anybody that's interested in culture, will, you know, definitely be one of those like bucket list items that somebody would want to go and see. I know it was for me. I remember thinking about it aloud and with some friends and saying that the haka is a like good that is traded, you know, is it Adidas that sponsor the All Blacks? There's all this commerciality around it. Essentially, that it was a gimmick, but was really forced to reconsider that position in a way that sticks with me to this day, because there is clearly a lot of cultural importance. It's critical in a way that, I mean, and maybe you can speak more about this than me, because it's, again, I can only access this from the outsider, but what was kind of told to me through various friends was that, like, this is not a gimmick. This is really critically important. It's not some sort of like affectation of Maori culture. Like, this is a really important part of being like a member of a post-colonial country, which is growing up in the UK very far beyond what I ever lived in.
No, I wish I had more. I don't. I wish I had more. I'll have to sit there and look that up. And it's a really crappy way to end part one, but we are going to end part one with this. You're listening to Distorted Shades of Grey with Mark Stern and me, Kalichio Sunwa. We'll be back talking about that Pepsi advert.
Hello, and welcome back to Distorted Shades of Grey. You're here with me, Mark Stern, and Kalichio Sunwa, as always. And we mentioned at the top of the show where Will Kalichio did the stunning, virtuous introduction of the Pepsi ads. As I said, don't think it's deserving of that degree of effort that went into writing that open. But this came out last week, and it's a lot has been written about it. A lot has been said about it. The ad showed Kendall Jenner wandering through the streets, picking up protests that seemed very visually similar to hashtag Black Lives Matter, and managed to solve the face-off with the incredibly unarmed and handsome security forces with a cool, refreshing Pepsi. And Kalichio, we couldn't not talk about it. I feel like we're compelled to talk about it. Obviously, this week's episode is appropriation, so we won't linger too much on the nitty-gritty of the Pepsi ad, but I guess we have to start somewhere, and this will be a good place for you to come in and talk about, you know, why is the Pepsi ad appropriation?
It's appropriation because the scene is literally a co-opted scene from last year, where it's a visual of a woman who gets dragged away by riot police officers in riot gear, and it became a famous picture. And if you haven't seen it, I think you're missing out. And
this is the girl at Baton Rouge, right?
Yeah,
standing in front of the riot geared, tooled up, very well armed, not handsome at all police officer.
Without the context of it being Baton Rouge, it could be anywhere. It could be a siege in Iraq. You know what I mean? That's how heavily tooled up these police are. So it's taking over the pain. It's deleting people from the history of what's going on. It's a clear case of like whitewashing and prettying it up. And it's just so factually correct. I think as much as it is like appropriation, it's capitalism trying to join in and be part of the resistance. And I mentioned that like World of Coke ad that Donald Draper makes in Mad Men, which actually happened in real life, and I shouldn't have said it in that way. Basically looking at it and saying, let's unify the world. And you can see their intention there. You can see their intention of having as many diverse people out there, to have the black kid in dreadlocks who's a breakdancer giving Kendall Jenner dap, like, to have the people sitting there having avocados and lattes. It was the most swing and a miss thing I can ever imagine. And I feel it was appropriation, just because I was going, you saw this happen last year and you want to make like profit out of it. I thought it was just dumb.
Yeah.
Just dumb.
I think, and I read a really excellent quote in an article talking about is it Diane Schultz's painting of Emmett Till that was in the news at the start of the month? And this quote is directed at artists, but I think it's true of Pepsi as well. So the writer was saying, artists must deal with legitimate criticism and dismiss illegitimate criticism as they come in. The key is knowing enough about your subject to distinguish between the two. So I guess the question being, what did Pepsi need to know in this situation to not fall in this pitfall of, you know, home running on cultural appropriation?
Well, there was the idea that if they actually had people who were part of Black Lives Matter, who were like genuine activists, if you had them involved in it in some way, it could have helped out. If you're actually trying to talk about activism and social change, then do that. But I think, like I said, they were trying to appeal to everybody. They were trying to not offend anybody. They were trying to make sure the diversity was up there, trying to make sure that people who loved law and order and policing were taken care of, people who loved diversity were taken care of, people who liked cellos being played on rooftops for some strange reason, they need to be taken care of. And it's one of those situations where if you are going to be about change, if you're going to be about protest or riot, a protest is basically boiled down to, I agree or I disagree. And you can't go to a protest which is agree or I disagree and make it into absolutely nothing. And I think it was just a whole lot of nothing. So, in fact, what do you think about that one?
So, there's two things you've said that I really want to elaborate on because I think it's super interesting. The first is, you know, you talked about the memes that were generated, and I think it's like absolutely hilarious. I'm all there for that conversation. The internet and its ability to ironically and sarcastically take apart any content is really one of the joys of my daily existence, especially in a world where Donald Trump is in America and Theresa May is in the UK. But what is just absolutely fascinating here, and the meme culture really drives this point home, is that in an article in The Atlantic titled "The Pepsi Advert Was 100% Success," or something like that, basically said, was talking about it was terrible, but it was successful. It had this quote saying that part of capitalism's job is to reproduce itself. And I think the memes are an excellent example of this. So this is one of my issues, is that kind of appropriation is bound to capitalism in a way that Don Draper and Mad Men being an excellent, you know, whole, what was it, 5 series of Mad Men in the end? I'm not sure. I'm going to have 6. To fact check that. 6. You know, they made a whole show kind of taking this apart about how advertising and capitalism is so fundamental to the way we understand the world now that, you know, it just constantly has to be consuming anything that it thinks is valuable and sellable to propagate its own idea of itself back to us so we spend more money. So it's kind of like, of course, we're going to get in these situations where there's these adverts that are really offensive. You know, you think that the Black Lives Matter campaign was beyond branding, but hey, here we are. It's clearly not. And following on from that, I think, so if you can even get past that, the conversation of cultural appropriation in this example, I think, can sometimes have a flimsiness to it that doesn't really engage me, because it kind of cements this idea that, you know, high and low culture, without actually engaging with what is so wrong about what it's doing. It's not just wrong that they set it in a Black Lives Matter context because that's offensive to Black Lives Matter. You actually have to go into, well, why does Black Lives Matter have such a cultural capital at the moment? And as an example of this, what was new to me about Black Lives Matter when I was reading Policing the Crisis That Led to Black Lives Matter, a book by Christina Heatherton, she was in an interview with Patrice Cullors, one of the founding members of Black Lives Matter. She said that, you know, we live in a police state. The police are the judge, the jurors, they're the social workers, they help, they're there to support, in inverted commas, mental health. They've become this all-encompassing institution, and that Black Lives Matter isn't saying, how do we reform them? How do we hold them accountable? It's actually saying, we don't want them. Why do they have to be there? these formats of police involvement in social society is incorrect. And I think that's a much more radical idea than even conversations about, oh yeah, Pepsi have appropriated Black Lives Matter. That sort of conversation is not going into that depth. It's not engaging with what Black Lives Matter is actually there to do. So you kind of get this layer of, yes, Pepsi is wrong, but if you need to talk about why Pepsi was wrong, you need to go really deep into the detail, not just say, oh, it's offensive to Black Lives Matter. Like you would say, oh, it's offensive to this sect of people, and not actually engage with who these people are, what their wants are, what their desires are. And I think this is kind of a long way around to an even bigger point, is that why do we want it to be right? Like, why do we want Pepsi to get this right? If you look at like the Super Bowl, where they had, I think there was Budweiser, Airbnb, Audi, all had various forms of branded content in the like the most expensive type of slots in the US, talking about social justice issues. And I think at a fundamental level, there's real problems here. Like, it's kind of like Starbucks, right? You go into Starbucks and they use fair trade coffee. So you go into Starbucks, you buy your coffee, and in the act of spending, you've relieved yourself of any guilt because, hey, it's fair trade coffee. I've spent money and also made something better for some poor person in the third world. Now, this is an argument that's put forward by Slavoj Žižek. I think I've talked about him on this program before, but I think it's really true. You know, like, yes, criticize Pepsi. Yes, it was cultural appropriation. Absolutely, they are right in pulling it. And, you know, probably no one's really gone into the nitty-gritty detail of why it was so wrong for them to appropriate this. But also, I'm kind of glad that they got it wrong, because getting it right would mean that there is a correct way of kind of commodifying Black Lives Matter to help a brand. And just because Airbnb is a brand that I want to engage with and Pepsi's not, doesn't make me any more comfortable.
I think that's been like the most five phenomenal minutes of like of commentary I've heard in a long time. That was superb, man. And even taking it away from the cultural appropriation, it's just dumb, wrong, and insensitive, right? The idea that you will be treated better if you hand police a Coke, or sorry, a Pepsi. Like, that idea is just egregious and wrong and insidious, and it makes it trivial. It makes things like police oppression, police states, police being there, over-policing, broken windows policing, it trivializes all those things. And could you imagine if, like, you know, Brody in The Wire was just like, oh, sorry, Przybylowski, here's a Coke. Well, here's a Pepsi. Sorted. We're all good now. Like, that in itself is disingenuous. And I think the point that you made there about the, does it absolve you from the guilt of helping a global, like, freaking conglomerate like that, is it clearly doesn't. Like, even that Nike ad that I saw, that was them promoting like the Muslim headgear, which I was like, oh my god, this is brilliant, like a major company and a corporation is doing that. And then I thought, oh, those poor kids in Bangladesh who are making the shoes, you know what I mean? And and I feel like it's our tagline on our Facebook page, and I feel like it's that classic case of like a man must have a code once again, in terms of how deeper you go into this, because the deeper you go into it, and you're right, it is audacious to be sitting there thinking, man, I wish Pepsi had got this right. For what? Like, for who?
Yeah, 100%. But also, I think I have thought about it too much. I think what you've said about, you know, it's just wrong, like, we could have probably left it there. You know, like, the conversation, we add fuel to the fire, right? Like, it's just wrong encapsulates that Pepsi ad in every way. And I don't want to, you know, we've not wasted your time, listeners. It was worth it. I hope you've enjoyed it. But I think we can agree that, like, that Pepsi ad at the end of the year will just be like, yeah, we're just going to leave it there. I don't think we need to say anything more. That was absolutely wrong.
All right. Before we go to the end of part two, just quickly, do you think the person got fired? Like, the person who signed off on that ad, do you think they got fired?
That's a really good question. Do you know,
just so you know, just to give it a bit of context, Sean Spicer still has a job. But did that person get fired?
Yeah, no, I really highly doubt that person got fired, because, you know, the guy from PricewaterhouseCoopers didn't get fired for ruining the Oscars. So, you know, that's far more important in our current cultural ladder of importance than Pepsi, I think. So, and yeah, Sean Spicer can conveniently forget the gas chambers in Europe and continues to have a job. You just, at some point, do you have to just look up to him and be like, man, what are you doing that I'm not? You can perform that poorly and still have a job.
I've said this before. I said him and Donald Trump are living the American dream of being absolutely mediocre, but exceptionally paid.
I think, is stretching the term, but yeah.
You think that they're less than mediocre? Brilliant. All right, that'll be the end of part two, where we believe that Donald Trump and Sean Spicer are less than mediocre. Stick with us for part three, where we finish off our conversation around cultural appropriation by speaking about the England rugby team and the song Swing Low, Swing Chariot. You're listening to Distorted Shades of Grey with Mark Stern and Kalichio Summer. Hello and welcome back to Distorted Shades of Grey. You're listening with me, Kalichio Sanwa, and Mark Stern. We are talking cultural appropriation this episode, and we'd like to get to one that we've been wanting to talk about for a while. And I suppose it all started from an article in the New York Times, which was how a slave spiritual became England rugby's anthem. And it's something that you've wanted to talk about for a while, Mark, so I'll let you take the lead on this.
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, incredibly sensitive, because Scotland rugby team went down to England and got absolutely destroyed. And I was just looking for excuses to beat up on the English rugby team, and this seemed like the most, my next best weapon.
So you're trying to use black grief here to take a shot at the English. Are you culturally appropriating black grief here, Mark? Good God.
See, look, we've done something right. We're giving the viewers an example to really get their teeth into. So we talked at the start of the show about history of colonialism as a key consideration for the cultural appropriation discussion. And I think this is very prominent here. And I think I'm particularly sensitive about it because colonialism is a topic that I read as much as I can about. I feel like it's a responsibility of mine growing up in a kind of center of colonial power to know about this in a way that it was never taught in schools to any great degree. And it really centers around this quote. There's a historian called Eric Hobsbawm. Hobsbawm. Anyway, can't remember how to say it. And he says, whoever says industrial revolution says cotton. And this is something that is just not at all present in the UK, that the industrial revolution, the technology that came with it, the privileges that gave Britain the status, its status as a world power all the way up until very recently, is like commercially 100% relying upon the slave trade and upon the cotton mills in southern states of America, because they imported the cotton from America as part of the triangular trade, with the slaves going from Africa to North America and cotton coming back to Europe. But none of this is examined in Britain today. It's definitely not, you know, Brexit Britain, we're going to have a red, white and blue Britain. Everything about British identity is based, or English identity especially, is based around this idea that we civilized the world, we are better because we designed these technologies, we were ahead of all of these other countries in getting there. And no one talks about the reasons why. And I think it's just, you know, in a minuscule example, the sporting arena always manages to engage people's nationalism. Like, it just, it can't not. You're there rooting for your team. There's flags. There's national anthems. It's a difficult conversation to have. And then so it's striking that the English rugby team, that I guess the supporters there probably generally don't sit around watching rugby talking about the history of colonialism, about the cotton industry, about the history of the slave trade, will sing to their team "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." And I don't think that they are, like, kind of individually responsible. There's no crime happening here, but collectively, this is a very strange situation to be in. So it just asks me from that perspective.
It's also the perspective of actually looking at how the song starts and originates from, in terms of it being sung at British games, right? Or games for the England rugby team. And when you look into it, you realise that it was first sung when England had, like, its first black rugby player for ages called Chris Otte. Yeah. So basically, he scored a try, and then they started to sing it towards him or sing it for him. So essentially, you could make the argument that the people who started singing it knew about the history of the song, knew what it was about, because they only sang it when the black guy scored. And what's, like, really disturbing about the song is, once you look into the history of it and what it's for, it's, the song is basically about black slaves wanting to die so they can go to heaven or go home. Like, listen to it, like, "Swing low, swing chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, swing chariot, coming for to carry me home. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home. I saw a band of angels coming after me, coming for to carry me home. If you get to heaven before I do, which is home, will you tell my friends I'll be coming there too?" Like, it's a song about people who are sick and tired of being slaves and longing for death, that gets used and targeted towards England's only black rugby player at the time. And if we look into the tradition of rugby in itself, rugby isn't a working class game. By virtue of rugby being a middle class game, can we completely divorce ignorance? Can we completely divorce ignorance from a group of people who would probably be private school educated, have a better idea of history and understanding of culture, and can we divorce it and say that they did not know what they were singing to Chris Otte at that time? I suppose the question then becomes, now, once it gets brought up and once people know and once you are aware of it, why the fuck would you want to sing that song?
It's really true. And it's not like this conversation is new. This thing about, oh, well, maybe people just aren't aware. It's been kind of brought up kind of on a relatively frequent basis every couple of years. When Six Nations is on in February and March and April, generally someone on the internet will write about it, and you can imagine the type of response it gets. And I'm just interested in your perspective, like, do you think that there is an amount of time that can pass that it becomes debased from its historical origins, and also debased from the way that it was used on the first black England player scoring a try, for it to be neutralized? Or do you think that it always carries a sharp sense of cultural appropriation that does denigrate and does kind of disproportionately harm a culture?
I think if you ever look into the history of it, there's no other way that you can, like, there's no other way you can take from it, right? I think what it also stems to is two things. One is the classic case of, as long as there is a set of people who are enjoying something, as long as there are a privileged class who are doing something, who don't want to be told how to live, behave, act from people who they think are lesser than them, then nothing's going to change. And this works whether it's the people singing "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." This works whether it's racism or discrimination. This also works whether it's sexism. As long as it's, like, the people who are not part of that privileged class, the privileged class end up having to give power. They have to, like, I think anyway, unless it's taken, you have to give it. The other point there is, like, it makes you curious about what we attribute to lyrics and how much we listen. And two examples here, something that I read, I think it was in The Independent as well, was I think Wales used the song Delilah by Tom Jones. And that's a song about a man who was with a prostitute, who sees the prostitute with another man, comes in, gets mad, gets jealous, kills her. That's domestic violence, that's murder. And it's sung all the time. You know what I mean? And we just think that it's okay. The other one is like Every Breath You Take, Every Move You Make by The Police. Again, that is like a song about stalking somebody. And we sit there and we listen to it and we think that it's absolutely fine and absolutely okay. I think the big thing there, and this is the other one where it comes down to the, it kind of ties it together as well. For example, it's the start of baseball season in America. And every year, the Cleveland baseball team, which are titled the Indians, with a caricature of Chief Wahoo, just it's basically a minstrel character. They get protest every year. And every year, the Major League Baseball have basically come out and said, yeah, this needs to stop. We're gonna make changes and phasing it out. And the only reason why they're making steps of phasing it out is because, one, they're making money, two, they don't want to offend people. So they're slowly getting rid of it, despite the fact that they know that it's wrong. And again, it's that classic case of, if you know it's wrong, get rid of it right now. But you know that the privileged class are going to get upset and mad. And that's why someone can be told Swing Chariot is racist, and they'd be like, no, it's not racist whatsoever. And even though they read it and learn about it, they go, it's back in the day. We're just dumb, bro. I just think that we're seriously dumb. Because I heard the lyrics of Delilah, and I thought, how can anyone sit there and like make this the
national song? I didn't know that about Delilah. It's really interesting. And, you know, another thing, the UK national anthem. Well, so before I say that, there is the piece about time. And a lot of the examples you gave are things that have happened very recently. Obviously, the Indians / Washington Redskins, the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins, is a ongoing kind of war on the side of American sports that is just ludicrous that it still continues. But going back to all the way back to the start of the program, I talked about Scotland and how that's my kind of entry point into this in a way that never really negatively affects my person. But in God Save the Queen, there's a verse that just doesn't get sung about, you know, going up to Scotland and murdering and killing people and all that sort of good fun. And even to this day, that sounds like a fun story, but it is actually still part of law. It's not a law that's enforced, but there is like these crazy archaic laws in the UK where you could go and kill a Scottish person if they're on your property every second Sunday of whatever. That's not a true, but it's an example of how it is. So these sins are still institutionalized, but not actually used. And so does it offend me when God Save the Queen is sung? No, apart from it being one of the worst songs in the world, one of the most boring songs in the world. But it's like time has passed. Like, that is no longer an immediate appropriation of my culture, I don't think. It doesn't offend me in that degree. So I guess it's the situation, the context. Again, these things all change. Maybe we shouldn't be looking to sports teams and sports fans to lead this fight, because from my perspective, traditionally, they've always been kind of problematic places. Like growing up in Glasgow, right, you've got one team singing songs about how we have to hang and murder all the Catholics, and then another team singing about how they have to hang and murder all the Protestants. You know, neither of those two are better than the other. Both of them are involved, they're from sports, they're soccer teams. I wouldn't ever turn up at those games expecting some sort of social progression.
Yeah, and like the bit there about time is, I mean, why do we want to be assholes? Like, why do we want to be like, oh, it's been 50 years, we can make age jokes now? Like, it's been 30 years since the Biafran War, now we can like make jokes about starving Biafrans. Again, like, it's you're well within your right to do that. It's well within your rights to sing Swing Low, Swing Chariot. The only thing that I can then say is, if you know what's going on, if you know what the history of it is, if you know what it means, then you're an asshole. And that's cool. Like, you can be an asshole. Like, that's absolutely fine. I dance to Bump and Grind. We said this last week. Like, I know. But it's just the ridiculousness of being like, oh, this song was sung by, like, people who you know, who were longing for death. Could you imagine in 100 years' time they found out that there were songs that Jews in the not-so-gassy gas chambers, according to Sean Spicer, imagine if there were songs that they were sing just before, like, the Holocaust that become sung at, like, a baseball game. And, like, dude, it was 150 yeah. years ago.
No, this is really true.
Again, it just goes towards, for me, I look at it and I think about human nature and why we would want to do that. Like, it's just, why would you want to, knowing what it says, knowing what it means, knowing what it represents, why would you want to do that? The audacity, like, the one that really gets me was when I found out that they were singing it at the Black Eye.
Yeah.
Like, they were actively singing it at the, and I was just like, all right, yeah. You're assholes. Like, you're genuinely assholes. If it was just a song that was sung whenever it was kickoff and it was just complete irony or complete coincidence, sure. But the targeted singing to the single Black guy in the team, yeah. It's like, all right, man, you definitely have some ulterior
motives. It would also be nice maybe for the English Rugby Union to face up to this conversation in a way that individually it'd be very hard to talk to all 80,000 fans in a stadium, but maybe they would donate a portion of their probably quite pricey tickets to certain charities or social organizations on an ongoing and, you know, professional yeah. relationship to support, you know, it doesn't even have to be charities related to people of color, just any sort of, this sort of atonement and recognition of, and kind of, I'm not saying that's a fee that they pay. That means they can continue to sing the song, but it's an admission of the fact, like you're saying, you might not be able to get everybody to stop singing the song. So maybe the next best thing is, as we talked about at the start, discuss payment. Like, should there be some sort of reparation involved?
I think that's tricky. And, like, I don't know how it would be administered. And in a very ironic way, I think the best thing that they could do is just come out, make a massive statement, and say, this is not who we are, that's not what we're about. And if people are singing it, then it's like, what the hell can we do? And also, like, do you pay reparations to all the black players who have previously played for England? Do you pay it to Chris Oti? How does that start? That's one where I get very iffy and murky about how reparations and payment and stuff like that would go, especially when I don't get any money part of that reparations or payment.
That's interesting, though. That's interesting. For me, that seemed like a plausible alternative, but actually it's more important that they come out and say that this is wrong and should stop and put measures in to stop it, not do as they have before and, like, actually commercialize it and making it a single that the English singers play before the World Cup and then sell,
yeah.
You know, not making it further part of the identity of English rugby.
And look, it's, I don't want to come across as a massive hypocrite here, but I'll just be factually honest. Man, you do dumb shit in the name of sport. You do terribly dumb shit in the name of sport. At the Rugby World Cup in New Zealand, the last one that I left, I got my face painted in a cross of St. George. It was England versus Georgia. I was drunk as hell. I was singing two World Wars and one World Cup. Because I'm an asshole. You know what I mean? Like a proper asshole. And that's just the things. And I'm singing Swing Low, Swing Chariot again, completely oblivious of what it is and what it meant. So I think the acknowledgement and just basically saying, yo, okay, we're not about this anymore. We're not going to have any official singing of this, we're not going to make any money off of this, we just want it to stop. And I think then you'll actually have a better conversation as to why the England rugby team is saying, hey, don't sing this song at our games.
I mean, I think that's a really complete thought right there.
All right, we do complete thoughts here at Distorted Shades of Grey. Mark, how do we end today?
Thanks for listening, I guess. Check us out. We're now on iTunes. We are on WordPress at dsgpod.org. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Follow us, like us,
We'll end it with that. Once again, everybody, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Continue to do it for the culture, and we will if you don't.
Cheers,
so
guys.
You don't have to.
At break of day, when that man drove away, I was waiting. I crossed the street to her house and she opened the door. She stood there laughing. I felt the knife in my hand.